for the last time this term. So I know Jeremy talked about Tolstoy last week, and this is a bit of a chronological leap backwards to Dostoevsky. It's because Jeremy could only make week 9, so that sequence was slightly jeopardized. But we're going back to mostly talking about Dostoevsky today. I'll bring in a little bit of Dickens, but really we're going to focus on crime and punishment. Some of the issues I'll touch on today, people who are in my seminar group, we may have talked about these a little bit. I'll explore some of the implications we may not have had time to talk about. Okay, so generally what today's lecture is going to be is about the centrality of the act of crime, particularly in Dostoevsky. But as I say, I'll approach the issue via Dickens. Okay, so it's December 22nd, 1849. Dostoevsky's in his late 20s, he's 29 years old, and he's about to be hung. He's standing in front of the scaffold. It's a cold day in St. Petersburg, and he's in a group of three people. There are groups of three people who are about to be executed for treason. Dostoevsky has been arrested and charged with conspiring against the Tsarist state. He's been associated with a particular group who were Russian liberals, and they have been agitating, holding meetings, distributing leaflets, etc., about the possibility of reform in Russia. This has obviously displeased the Tsar. The Tsar's secret police has arrested about 19 people, Dostoevsky being one of them, as is his older brother, Mikhail. And they've been both, as far as he can tell, has been sentenced to death. So he's waiting to be executed, and he thinks he has a minute to live. And later on in the day, he writes down what he went through that moment, what he felt at that moment. The execution was a mock execution. They didn't know that. And the last second, the sentence was commuted to prison in Siberia. The prisoners weren't told. They thought they were going to be executed. Then they were brought back from the scaffold and taken to the prison. And this is what Dostoevsky writes in a letter to his brother, who's in a different prison, about the day later on, in the sort of a few hours later in the evening. Today, December 22nd, 1849, we were driven to Semyonovsky parade ground. There, the death sentence was read to us all. We were given the cross to kiss, swords were broken over our heads, and our final toilet was arranged, white shirts. Then three of us were set against the post so as to carry out the executions. We were summoned in threes. Consequently, I was in the second group, and there was not more than a minute left to live. I remembered you, my brother, and all yours. And the letter goes on for a while, ending with those interesting words. Life everywhere is life. Life is in ourselves and not in the external, is how the letter ends. And Dostoevsky, throughout his career, will work those sentiments into his fiction, ranging from The House of the Dead down to Crime and Punishment. So I want to focus on that experience, what it means for him as a person, but also what it means for Dostoevsky, that particular moment, for his entire era. Remember those words, life everywhere is life, life in ourselves and not in the external. Now, a few years before Dostoevsky goes through, the young Dostoevsky goes through this particular episode, another slightly older writer in his youth, Charles Dickens, also visits the prison. This is about roughly 20 odd years, nearly 30 years before this particular moment in Russia. This is, of course, in London, and Dickens is visiting his father in Marshalsea Prison. Of the many prisons in London, Marshalsea was the one devoted to holding debtors, people who failed to pay their debt. The idea was they would be held there indefinitely till their debt was cleared, and Dickens's father, John Dickens, has been arrested for failing to clear his debt. And the young Dickens, he's around 12 years old at that point, visits his father in Marshalsea. And this is how he recalls that particular visit in his autobiography. "My father was waiting for me in the lodge, and we went up to his room and cried very much. And he told me, I remember, to take warning by the Marshalsea and to observe that if a man had £20 a year and spent £19, 19 shillings and sixpence, he would be happy. But that a shilling spent the other way would make him wretched." Again, this episode of visiting his parent in his father in Marshalsea will appear fictionally reworked throughout Dickens's career, most memorably, of course, in Little Dorrit. But also, echoes of it hangs over in David Copperfield, in Great Expectations, etc. The form of the prison as a formative experience. Now, obviously, this is not exactly the kind of experience that Dostoevsky went through. He really believed he was about to be hung at that point in time. But Dickens recalls this episode later in his life with a real powerful feeling of, in his recollection, nearly 40, 50 years on, about how humiliated he felt during that visit, and indeed throughout the many visits he paid his father at Marshalsea. That sense of humiliation, personal humiliation, and what crime now associated with a parent did to him as a young child. As I said, Dostoevsky went to Siberia after his commuted execution and spent incredibly traumatic but also formative years in the Siberian prison. We have a large stack of his letters written both to his family, but in particular to his brother Mikhail, who was the who was his older brother. He looked up to him very much, and also was really the activist in the family. Dostoevsky was mostly following his older brother's footsteps in some ways. And of the many prison letters, I've given you an extract, one of them. And this is in 1854. "In 4 years in prison, I at last came to distinguish human beings among the thieves. Will you believe me, there are deep, strong, beautiful characters. And what a joy it was to discover gold beneath the rough, hard shell. And not one, that should be two, sorry, not two, but several." So prison for Dostoevsky, and remember Siberia, is a pretty extreme kind of place, and there are indeed large page and many number of pages Dostoevsky devotes to outlining the harshness of the Siberian prison. By the end of the fourth year, though, he gives us a very different view of a prison as a rehabilitative place where, in some senses, his soul has been regenerated. That's at least how he's writing up the experience. Life, deep, strong, beautiful characters, of what a joy it was to discover gold beneath the rough, hard shell. Echoing, of course, the end of that letter, life everywhere is life, life in ourselves and not in the external. I don't want to over-determine this particular novel in the light of the biographical experiences of Dostoevsky, but what you'll note immediately, both about Dickens and Dostoevsky, as they recollect their early formative experiences with crime and punishment, those recollections operate at simultaneous levels, at many levels. Firstly, of course, they recognize these experiences as being vital to how they themselves, their own personalities, were formed over the years. Secondly, this is evident in many letters and diary entries, etc., their own commentaries about their own fiction, they recognize the figure of the prison as being a vital, transformative space. As I said, they rework these experiences throughout the course of their fiction. So it has a literary and aesthetic value, the figure of the prison. Finally, both of them expand this experience of crime and punishment beyond the personal to a generalized social and philosophical question about their time. So the experience of crime, their personal intimate brushes with crime, work at least three levels for both the writers in an autobiographical memorial sense, in a literary aesthetic sense and in their general understanding of what their times are about or were about. Okay, so one of the things that I want to talk a little bit about today is what really, how those three levels really work in this particular novel. This is a very strange novel. There's no mystery about the crime itself. We were talking a little bit about it in the seminars. There is no mystery about how the crime is committed. Indeed, the detection of the criminal is almost a foregone conclusion here. From the very first pages, we are already in the mind of Raskolnikov. The murder has already, what turns out to be, in fact, a double murder, has already been meditated. There are various debates that are going on in his head. And of course, that also, in some ways, is looks forward to his ultimate, his final act of surrender and capturing if you like, the solution of the crime by Porfiry. The weird thing about Porfiry is, unlike other literary detectives that we might meet in 19th century, he actually does very little detection. There are no scenes of chase, there's no scene of collecting, gathering evidence. There are no mysteries about when and how it happens. So really, from the very beginning, what this particular novel is asking us to consider is crime not so much as a mystery that has to be solved for intellectual entertainment or even a sense of social comfort that these murders have been committed and ultimately the murderer is captured, etc., but rather crime, what crime means to the formation of one person's soul, if you want to use that word, and Dostoevsky uses that word deliberately throughout his novel, but also what it means to a whole era. The mystery, in other words, is not in the mechanics of crime, but in the act itself. Okay? So in other words, in some ways, you could read this as a kind of anti-crime novel. It's a philosophical novel about crime, but it's not so much concerned with the solution or the resolution of the problem of criminality or the act of criminality. Rather, it uses crime to explore the modern soul, the various contradictions, the travails, and the formation of the modern soul. Okay, so that's the first thing to keep in mind about both Dostoevsky and Dickens, their personal formative experiences of crime and how they expand those experiences out of the individual into a general inquiry about society. And not just society, about really the interiority of human beings in their times. The second point is, of course, both the writers are in some ways obsessed with where the large volumes of crime is taking place during their times, namely the city. We talked about this a little bit when we are talking about the city as a space. Both the writers are utterly mesmerized by the various unique, in some ways, spatial configurations of the cities they find themselves in, London and St. Petersburg. Here is Dostoevsky writing about St. Petersburg. This is the second extract on the second part of your handout. Dostoevsky, you remember, just like Dickens, practiced journalism in his early years. He is a journalist. He's writing. Mainly, he's on the kind of what you might call the sort of daily affairs beat of this new newspaper in St. Petersburg. Again, just like Dickens, exploring the various facets of the city. Here's what he writes about St. Petersburg. I think I should like to turn myself into Eugène Sue, the best-selling French novelist and journalist who wrote this series of books called The Mysteries of Paris, which was both national and international bestsellers, and describe the mysteries of Petersburg. I have a passionate love for mystery, says Dostoevsky. I'm a fantasist, a mystic, and I confess to you that Petersburg, I do not know why, has always seemed to me to be some kind of mystery. The whole city, not just one human being, not just one human being's action. To Dostoevsky, St. Petersburg stands for something larger than the physical configuration of the urban form. It's a mystery. It holds the key to an understanding of the entire century. That's what Dostoevsky's early feeling is. And of course, he's a great admirer of Dickens in a recent, in fact, in a couple of recent biographies, one by Michael Slater, which is listed at the end of your handout. There are suggestions that Dostoevsky met Dickens, interviewed him while he was traveling in England as a young person. Later turns out, there's a controversy about this proposition, it turns out later that that particular letter where he makes that claim may or may not be authentic, etc. What is authentic, however, is his recorded admiration for Dickens. We understand Dickens in Russia, this is on your handout, he says, I'm convinced almost as well as the English and maybe even all the subtleties, maybe even we love him no less than his own countrymen, and yet how typical, distinctive, and national Dickens is. And these are going to be qualities that Dostoevsky himself gives great importance to as a writer, distinctive, national, typical. Remember, we were talking a little bit about this when we were discussing Tolstoy. The question of Russia, what is distinctive about Russia? What is typical about Russia? What is national about Russia? That becomes an important question to all the Russian writers of the 19th century. In what ways is it similar to and different to what they call Europe? Okay? And one of the ways in it, which Russian distinctiveness is posited in the 19th century is to look at how different its cities are from the European capitals, the metropoles. So one of the things, of course in turn, one of the things that is distinctive about the cities are their crime rates, how human beings behave when they congregate together in hitherto unprecedented numbers, and what effect that has on their moral behavior and their relationship with each other. Dickens, some of you will remember, we are talking about when we were discussing him, is fascinated by London, not just as a writer, but as a practicing journalist. He goes on all these night walks through Seven Dials and Covent Garden, etc., and writes about the underside, the dark side of London, not out of some kind of prurient curiosity about the criminal class, but he senses, like Dostoevsky, if you can solve the mystery of the city, why people behave in such sudden ways, and this particular novel is, of course, full of people who behave weirdly in the middle of a city. Remember the encounters Raskolnikov has at various points as he's walking St. Petersburg, women who throw themselves off bridges as in the same bridge that Raskolnikov is waiting indefinitely for something to happen, or a young girl who's been stalked, Raskolnikov thinks, by this lecherous old man, and he jumps to his rescue, etc. The horse carts that suddenly turn a corner and knock over people like Marmeladov. There's this environment of nervous energy and tension that at any point spills over into disaster. And what both Dickens and Dostoevsky are concerned with is that there's something in this environment. There's something, there's a key to how we live our lives, the central element of modern life that is captured by all this bustling nervousness that always threatens to teeter over into anarchic violence. Both the writers are invested in solving that mystery. If they can decode that mystery, something about our world will become clear. And this, of course, you can see echoes of this in our contemporary. This is a very influential thesis, of course, it becomes a very influential thesis, not just in 19th century European literature, but literature worldwide. You can see something similar going on in, let's say, a mammoth recent work by Roberto Bolaño, 2666. Any of you've attempted to tackle that novel? Mere 3,000 pages? No? The central section of it is set in Mexico, in Ciudad Juarez, the northern Mexican city, where over the last 15 years, close to 10,000 women and children have been murdered, and unsolved murders. And this middle section is really a litany of their names. There's this novel of 3,000 pages. For about 600 pages, what we get are names and case studies, just literally like police reports. And this isn't a novel that starts with a literary conference about German literature, and four professors who gather to discuss this obscure German writer, etc. What Bolaño says starts, introduces a section with this simple sentence that in these deaths are encoded the mystery of today's world. And there's no resolution of those deaths, the cases are never solved, but there's something about that industrial scale of femicide, of women being killed systematically, that tells us something about this world. Pretty much the same kind of wager that Dostoevsky makes, not by looking at mass death in St. Petersburg, by looking at one death, one or two deaths actually, mustn't forget Lizaveta, two deaths, and two murders committed by Raskolnikov. There's something about these deaths, there's something about this city that is mysterious, and at the core of that mystery lies the key to our world today. And note Dostoevsky's own emphasis on himself being a fantasist. He says, I'm a fantasist, a mystic. Of course, he's writing here in the kind of persona of a narrator who's going through the city. In Petersburg's visions, Petersburg Visions in Verse and Prose, which is an early journalistic piece that he published. Note the echo, though, that raises in Marshall Berman's analysis of Dostoevsky in All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. You'll have been referred this work throughout your course and in many other courses, so you may be familiar with this. The modernism of underdevelopment, says Berman, is forced to build on fantasies and dreams of modernity, to nourish itself on an intimacy and struggle with mirages and ghosts. In order to be true to the life from which it springs, it is forced to be shrill, uncouth, inchoate. It turns in on itself and tortures itself for its inability to single-handedly make history. Note how weirdly this passage echoes Raskolnikov. It is forced to be shrill, uncouth, inchoate. You could argue that's the general tone of Raskolnikov's many declarations and actions throughout the novel. People are constantly surprised by the fact that he suddenly breaks out into this apparently incoherent long monologues. It turns in on itself. This is exactly what Raskolnikov does. He describes his own affliction and illness as his mind turning in on itself and tortures itself for its inability to single-handedly make history. This is exactly what Raskolnikov's essay that he publishes about murder and about how exceptional individuals should be allowed to get away with murder, literally. That's exactly the claim that it makes. To inability to single-handedly make history, this is exactly what Raskolnikov says, and at various points of the novel, that he wants to do, like Napoleon, like Muhammad. Those are the comparisons he makes. But he's unable to do so. He's frustrated by both this simultaneous promise of modernity, all individuals can fulfill their own potential to the hilt. So he's the lure of that promise, the fulfillment of the promise is there. Simultaneously, he's unable to fulfill it. He tests this out by murdering, as Porfiry says, here's a modern murder because you kill two people for a theory. Not because of money, not because of your illness, but to test out a theory. What is that theory? That in the modern world, every individual is entitled to greatness. Okay? As Raskolnikov tests this out, what he finds instead is, of course, the modern world is a much more complicated affair than that particular promise holds. So for Berman, what Dostoevsky's text captures is, I used the word modern soul before, are the contradictions that tear apart the singularity of an individual in modernity. It's the simultaneously diverse directions in which an individual is pulled. On the one hand, the promise of complete freedom and complete power and the complete satiation of all your desires. On the other hand, the inability to fulfill any of those promises and the resultant really violent frustration that is then expressed in various murderous acts. Now, how you express that contradiction in a novel is really what both Dostoevsky and Dickens struggle with. Dostoevsky calls himself a fantasist because he realizes that this modern conundrum cannot be written in the given formulas or the given forms of standard prose fiction. You have to invent a different language for it. You have to try and capture that feeling of simultaneous hallucination and disorientation that Raskolnikov goes through, and that cannot be done in the language, let us say, of Tom Jones, of the classic 18th century realist novel, or the epistolary novel that we have looked at before, Werther's The Sorrows of Young Werther, Jane Austen's Emma. That particular linguistic and formal tradition, both for Dickens and Dostoevsky, remember when we're talking about Dickens, we're talking about fantastic realism or romantic realism, that word comes into play. How do you express this soul in torture, the modern soul in torture, that is not just singular, but collective? But you have to tell that through the story of this one person, in this case, Raskolnikov. So you have to invent a new idiom for it, which is why Dostoevsky calls himself a fantasist and someone obsessed with mysteries. His prose has to mimic the inward turn that Raskolnikov suffers. His mind turns in on itself. And throughout the novel, we get this elliptical, broken, fragmentary consciousness that is a lot of time is going on in Raskolnikov's head. He himself says, I don't know the reality. How real is my imagination? I don't know the reality of what I'm thinking, which is where the dream episodes become crucial. Just before he commits the murder, there's this three-page description of that hallucinatory dream of Mikolka, the peasant, beating his horse to death, given to us in vivid details. Following on to that, shortly after that, of course, Raskolnikov arrives to commit the murders. Now, there is no direct correlation between the two. What we get is instead a portrait of a mind at peril because of itself. So how do you tell that story? Poe is trying to do that in America around about the time Dickens is working, if you think of those early crime mysteries of Poe, which are intensely hallucinatory, right? Dickens tries to do that with his Tales of London, where the prose mimics in some ways the weirdness of London. Think of Pip's first experiences of looking at London in Great Expectations. And Dostoevsky is trying to similarly capture that mild in tumult and peril that Raskolnikov experiences in St. Petersburg. So the second point really is, the first point was the centrality of crime to both the personalities of the writers. The second point is about where the crime happens, i.e. in these suddenly mysterious, huge configurations called the modern 19th century city. And what the writers are interested in is mapping the correlation between the urban physical form of urbanity and the mental tumult that all these people, forever on the brink of these nervous outbursts, what is the correlation between the two, and what kind of style can you, with what kind of prose can you write that particular story? Of course, this has a direct link into modernism later on. As we'll see, the prose tries to mimic the stream of consciousness of the isolated, atomized modern individual. We'll see a little bit of that in the beginning of, towards the beginning of next term when we do Hunger, Knut Hamsun's novel about a lost soul in Oslo or Christiania. Okay, so the third point is really on the novel's obsession. As I said, the novel treats crime not so much as not just as a sociological problem. This is what Razumihin, who acts in many ways as the sane narratorial self in the novel, says, that the problem with socialists is, there are many problems with socialists for Dostoevsky, but one of the problems is they try to explain crime as a social phenomenon, the fact that it might be related to poverty, etc. But what they fail to recognize, says Razumihin, is the fact of nature itself, the naturalness of nature, is what he says. What happens, it's all very fine to look at crime as a product of poverty, but the correlate of that thesis, that is to say, if you abolish poverty, you will abolish crime, does that hold? Or is this something in the human soul itself that propels it towards transgression? That's what Razumihin proposes in one of the many debates about why people commit crime. So the focus of the novel really is on this particular mystery. Remember, in Russia, one of the things, and we'll come to this in the conclusion of the novel, one of the things Dostoevsky is doing here in the novel, as a journalist, he's had very good experience of this wide range of debates going on about the direction in which Russia is moving in the 19th century. So there are various propositions. On the one hand, you have this idea of Russia's catching up in some ways with the, quote, progress that has already been made in Western Europe, and it's on that trajectory towards modernity, and it should stay on that trajectory to modernity. That's one proposition. The second proposition from the Russian conservatives is Russia is not suited to that particular kind of modernity because it has its own unique history that is separate from Europe. Alongside that proposition has come after the mid-century, after the emancipation of the serfs, etc., has come this kind of reflux of religiosity, which in the novel is embodied in Sonia. So a third strand of thought has been to save its soul from the perils of modernity, Russia must hold on to its spiritual, ancient spiritual sanctity. And the fourth proposition, or one of the propositions that counteract that, and this is really what Razumihin does in the novel, is at one point of the novel says, Razumihin says, mistakes are important, errors are important, because only when you make errors can you learn the truth. So this trial by error, this idea of the building, of the lesson, of how both individuals and collectives should be free to make mistakes, because it is through their mistakes that they will learn and progress will be achieved. That's another proposition that is very much alive historically in Russia at this point. So you have the kind of extreme reaction to Tsarist repression, the violent, revolutionary, violent overthrow of the system that Raskolnikov himself quite often articulates. The entire system is violent. They kill millions. Why can't I kill one person or two people, etc.? There's that model. There's the more reformist model of Razumihin, and then there's the model of religiosity that Sonia performs. So what Dostoevsky does here in this novel, it's very cleverly, he patterns the contemporary debates raging in Russia about which historical path Russia should take, and that will ensure its future. But the trick is, he does that by focusing not on the mass, but on the turbulent soul of a single individual, which is Raskolnikov. And the problem here is the problem that Razumihin articulates earlier on. Okay, fine, you're suggesting that with progress, all these things will disappear, but will it? Or is there something in the human soul that's always cankered? If so, how can we ensure that progress can be made at all? As Dickens says or one of Dickens's characters says memorably in Our Mutual Friend, the evil doer cannot escape the slower torture of incessantly doing the evil deed again and doing it more efficiently. Is this a universal proposition? Once somebody commits evil, or commits to evil, is it the case that evil itself becomes a reason for his or her existence, i.e. he or she is compelled to commit it again and again because evil itself becomes an attraction, a reason for his or her existence? And can this at all ever be wiped away by the lure of progress? This is something, as Dickens says in Our Mutual Friend, and of course what Dostoevsky does in this novel, that obsesses the two writers. Fine, there are these old historical paths a nation can take. Will it actually solve the problem of the human soul, in the tormented human soul in modernity? And I've given you a range of positions that the novel takes on this, mostly articulated by Porphyry here, the so-called detective in the novel. As I said, for Porphyry, this case is not, it's already solved in some ways. He says, you won't run away, to Raskolnikov. The fugitive's life is hard and hateful, and your first need is for a definite position and existence. Your first need is for a definite position and existence. And this crime has nothing to do with money. It's got nothing to do with grand theories about extraordinary human beings. For Porfiry, Raskolnikov has killed two women for this. A definite position and existence. That's a quite interesting formulation. How do you kill people to achieve at a definite position and existence? And indeed, Porfiry is not far wrong. Throughout the novel, we see all these false confessions, right? All these people who suddenly are in a rush to confess to crimes that they haven't committed. And Porfiry says, this is a sign of our times. These people know they haven't committed the crime. Why are they coming to me and confessing to this double murder? That's a kind of interesting question, right? Why would you confess? And for Porfiry, these false confessions are a sign of the times precisely because they show this huge lack that individuals are perceiving in themselves. They don't have a definite position. They don't know who they are in this world. The hope is if they commit crime and are appropriately punished, then at least there'll be a semblance of both moral and legal order in this world that they can believe in, right? Thus, they're in trouble to be punished, all the four crimes they haven't committed. They're confessing to these imaginary crimes in the hope that something in this process of false confession, something will be confirmed. What is that something? It might be that it is a legal and moral order that still exists despite all the appearances of the turbulences and the kind of relativism of values that seem to exist in the modern world. So something has to be confirmed, your definite position and existence. And he goes on to say, this is an obscure and fantastic case, etc. Oh, when the whole of life is dedicated to comfort, you need a semblance of morality. You need to confirm the existence of morality, which is why you commit a crime, or indeed confess to a crime that you haven't committed. That's Porfiry's view, and that's one view of the perils of the modern soul. Raskolnikov himself fluctuates between position. On the one hand, quite often he'll say, I didn't kill a woman, I killed a louse. I killed a principle, he says. So quite often, sometimes he'll take falsely, because he himself is aware of this, he takes on the burden of collective justice. This woman stands for a principle. What is that principle? That economic transaction and money stands for everything in this world. Alina is a usurer, obviously. So on the behalf of humanity, I take this tremendous burden of ridding the world of this evil principle. On the other hand, he frequently contradicts that position as he tells Sonia, I did not commit murder in order to use profit and power. I gained to make myself a benefactor of humanity. Rubbish. I simply murdered. I murdered for myself alone. What I needed to find out as soon as possible, was whether I was a louse like everybody else or a man. So that's a paradox of the only way he can confirm to himself that he's a human being is to kill another human being. Okay, so he inhabits those two positions. On the one hand, he's saying there's a collective reason for murdering Alina. On the other hand, and contradictory to it, it has nothing to do with any collective justice at all. It was only to prove to myself that I can be a human being. So as Louise Welch says in a fairly old article by now, Raskolnikov's murder, what the novel propels us towards is this problem, that Raskolnikov's murder must mean something. It has a meaning. But Raskolnikov himself doesn't know what it is. And over the novel, we find out, along with him, what those various meanings can be. But at the time it is committed, its significance is far, but this is on your handout, the last bit in section 3. It is committed, its significance is far more evident. Murder, says Northrop Frye, is doubtless a serious crime, but if private murder were a major threat to a civilization, it would not be interesting to read about it. So Raskolnikov's theory suggests that the murders might in fact portend a threat to civilization. But even Porfiry, the police examiner, suggests that there are more significant and monstrous crimes. Porphyry clearly says, it's good that you didn't have a different theory. In that case, you could have killed millions. The fact that you had this theory about the individual transgression, etc., meant that you killed one person or two people. If you had a different thesis, you might have just, you know, killed hundreds of people. So clearly, Porphyry doesn't believe in Raskolnikov's own theorization of the meanings of murder. Neither is it clear to Raskolnikov at the moment or throughout the course of the novel that what these actions mean. He fluctuates between these two poles. So what the novel gives us is not one settled meaning of why people commit crimes or what crime stands for. Like the city, crime reveals a whole host of meanings, and all those meanings are available at certain points of time, but none of them are settled meanings. Like the city, it is a mysterious formation. Okay. Porphyry has a thesis about murder, Razumihin has a thesis about murder, Raskolnikov has several theses about murders. All of them cancel each other out at some point. Okay? So what we are given is this panorama of causality whereby murder stands for various things or means various things. Never in the novel is it clear that it means there's a core to that act itself. As I said, like the city, it is telling you something. It is telling you something that is not necessarily reducible to a mechanical causation. I committed murder because I was hungry. I committed murder because I'm poor. I committed murder because I want to prove myself I'm a human being. All these positions are offered, and because of the way the novel is written, i.e. through Raskolnikov's delirious point of view, through Porphyry's world-weary and in some ways cynical point of view, all these positions cancel each other out. So what you have here is crime as a symbol, a symptom of an affliction of a whole era, but not tied to one single meaning. The punishment section of the title, Crime and Punishment, seems at first glance to gesture that there, in fact, can be a resolution to this problem of the mystery of crime. What does it tell us about this world? What is it telling us about modernity? What is it telling us about Russia? What is it telling about us about Raskolnikov? There seems that the punishment bit of the novel, which is to say, at the very base level, of course, Raskolnikov surrenders. He's imprisoned, much like Dostoevsky was, in Siberia. And in prison, through a series of formative experiences, he comes to believe what Dostoevsky says in that letter, that life everywhere is life. So he commits, in some ways, to life. But, if we have time, I'll read the last section of the novel. That is a very tenuous, deliberately tenuous conclusion to the novel. Now, normally the novel is read, and there's one possible, let us call it a shallow reading of the novel, which might suggest that Sonia is the redemptive principle of the novel. Of course, Raskolnikov himself, but there's good reasons to believe this because Raskolnikov himself offers that possibility. Sonia, he says, we must be together. Why? Because Sonia embodies the selfless, unorthodox, it has to be said, but selfless Christian principles that Dostoevsky, but also Russia at that time, or a large section of the Russian population and intellectuals believed would be the kind of ladder that would lift them out of the morass of modernity. And that is held, that is given to us in a fully fleshed form in Sonia in the novel. But this may not be the resolution, the actual resolution that the novel offers us. So in Sonia you have a principle of redemption. But this is what Ilya Kligger, this is on the final page of your handout, says. As an enigma soliciting narrative solutions, Dostoevsky's socially undetermined hero is best understood as a formal condition of possibility of exploring Russia's position at the intersection point of multiple historical vectors. So as I was saying earlier, in Russia, the debate at that point is which of the history, paths of history that Russia can follow. What Kligger is suggesting here, because Raskolnikov, even in the prison and after the prison, his mind is left deliberately unsettled. I'll read the final passage in a bit. Dostoevsky doesn't give us one resolution to all these possibilities that is in front of Raskolnikov and in front of Russia as a nation. As such, the hero enables a series of temporal shapes laden with historiographic significance, etc. I'm not going to go into that. A reinscription of Crime and Punishment into the context of the journalistic debates of the period of great reforms thus allows us to read the novel as a political allegory that stages and imaginatively resolves the socio-temporal contradiction structuring a world torn between conflicting demands of continuity and radical change. Those are quite kind of dense words. I'm just going to flesh out what that means finally by reading that passage, well, actually two passages. Just before we are given that final state of Raskolnikov's mind in the final paragraph, he has this, remember he's in prison now, he's achieved the punishment that he wants to achieve, according to Porfiry, because people commit crimes in order to confirm the existence of a moral order. Apparently that has been achieved. He has confessed, he has been transported to Siberia. He's undergoing what should be a transforming experience of punishment, just like Dostoevsky, after 4 years in prison, writes about the discovery of gold under the harsh nuggets of prison population. So Raskolnikov, we assume, will be transformed by this experience in prison and will give up his huge delusions of individual power and freedom, etc. But there are two things that happens towards the end of the novel. One, there are three pages devoted to one of Raskolnikov's typical dreams. What does this dream, what does this dream consist of? Okay. He had dreamt in his illness that the whole world was condemned to fall victim to a terrible, unknown pestilence which was moving on Europe out of the depths of Asia. All were destined to perish except a chosen few, a very few. There had appeared a new strain of trachinae, microscopic creatures parasitic in men's bodies. But these creatures were endowed with intelligence and will. People who were infected immediately became like men possessed and out of their minds. But never, never had any men thought themselves so wise and so unshakable in truth as those who were attacked. Never had they considered their judgments, their scientific deductions, or their moral convictions and creeds more infallible. Whole communities, whole cities, and nations were infected and went mad. Okay, so that's what Raskolnikov's dreaming. It's a bit like the zombie apocalypse for intellectuals, right? What has happened here is this parasite has infected everyone. You know, this is a standard zombie scene, 28 days later, etc. Cities are laid waste as people feed on each other, but except here, the way they're feeding on each other is through a conviction that only what they think is right. Only their point of view is valid, their complete belief in their own scientific deductions, morality reasons, etc. That's the core of the dream of the final dream of Raskolnikov. A plague of certainty, a plague of that is destroying human beings of fundamentals, of beliefs. People who are infected by this plague cannot believe that they are wrong, and this is destroying humanity. Right? So that's the dream he has. What happens in the final paragraph? So remember, the core of the dream is the perils of certain belief, okay? There was a New Testament under his pillow. Mechanically, he took it out. Mechanically, okay? Not with conviction, not with certainty, mechanically. It was hers, the very one from which she had read to him, this is Sonia's, to him by the raising of Lazarus. He did not open it even now. He fails to submit to this final conviction. But an idea flashed through his mind. Could not her beliefs become my beliefs now? Her feelings, her aspirations at least, and the sentence is, it doesn't end there. It's a series of ellipses. And then she goes on, then Dostoevsky goes on to say, but that is the beginning of a new story, the story of the gradual renewal of a man, of his gradual regeneration, of his slow progress from one world to another, of how he learned to know a hitherto undreamed of reality. We're not given that story. That reality is undreamed of. Raskolnikov is mechanically reciting or trying to be convinced by Sonia's aspirations, ideals. He can't even open the Bible that she's left for him. So if we think that Raskolnikov's punishment has finally converted him to Sonia's ideals of beliefs of self-sacrifice, of religiosity, etc., then we might be much mistaken. What the novel ends on is this nightmare that Raskolnikov has about what happens when people believe, okay? What happens when people are convinced of something and act on it? Even in the final sentences, he cannot give himself up to it. He can't read the Bible. He thinks that he should do. He almost fakes it. He thinks, can Sonia's ideals not be mine? We are not told how that sentence ends. The world in front of Raskolnikov might be an undreamed world, not only for him, but for everyone who experiences the conundrums that he goes through. And that is what the novel ends. So the mystery of That is how the novel ends. So the mystery of criminality in the novel, the action of crime, may indeed be that those actions and what they stand for may never be resolved. Instead, what they'll go on generating are these plurality of contradictory meanings that finally tear us apart in this world. It's a cheerful message for Christmas. So enjoy your break. Don't take Raskolnikov too seriously. You've got essays to write. I'll see you after the break.